listening. My son is a member of the firm representing the respondent. It's my understanding that he has not tried the case and does not participate in the appeal. There's an objection to my sitting by either county. Your argument from the table.
The Supreme Court petition will be represented by Mr. Lennon.
Supreme Court. This case involves a contract for the construction of a building. The Austin Company entered into a contract to build a building on property owned by Vaughn Building Corporation. Contract was entered into in 1968, April 23, 1968, and it was substantially completed, and the building accepted January 8, 1969. The contract had two provisions in it in regard to the responsibility of the parties from time to time. It had paragraph number 13, which specifically provided that Austin guarantees the work against defective workmanship and material for 1 year from the date of completion of the work, as follows, and then it mentioned that could give a written notice of any claim defect. But that was preceded by Article 11, which specifically provided that the payments from time to time didn't constitute acceptance of work that of problems that were not open and obvious. But it also provided that at the final inspection, there would be a final inspection of all of the work, including that which was open and was not open and obvious, and that the final certificate of payment shall be conclusive evidence of performance of the contract. And this happened in 1969. So they specifically provided in the contract as to how you handle things that are not open and obvious. The first claim that was made in writing provided by the contract was more than a year after the building was completed. So it was not within the one-year warranty. Now, the question that we have is whether or not a contract may have an express warranty that excludes an implied warranty. Now, we think that the general rule has always been that an express warranty may exclude an implied warranty. Now, the appellant, the respondent, rely on several provisions of Business Commerce Code, which not sure makes any difference, but at the time this contract was entered into in 1968, the Business Commerce Code was not in effect. The amendment bringing real estate under the Business and Commerce Code didn't come until 1975. So if the Business and Commerce Code makes any difference, we doubt that it does. It's not involved in this suit. Now, this court in Umber versus Morton handed down a decision, and the court specifically recognized implied warranties. But in Umber versus Morton, there really was not a Warren is that attempted to exclude anything. Umber versus Morton was where his person sold the land and the building, and the only warranty he made was a general warranty in the deed. There was no warranty that will be responsible for a year or anything. So there was no attempt in Umber versus Morton to place any kind of limitations that would exclude any kind of implied warranty. And that been that was a home, and the court held in that case that there was an implied warranty insofar as the inhabitability and workmanship was concerned. But there was no attempt in any way to make either an express warranty except this time in the warranty deed, and there were no other contractual provisions in that case. Ours, of course, is a great deal different from that. Our contract specifically provided that we will be and we will have an inspection before final completion, and that inspection and final acceptance and payment will constitute a compliance with the contract and its exclusive evidence of the performance of the contract. So we think this case is in a great deal different posture than Umber versus Morton was. Now, the Court of Civil Appeals referred to Wattell versus Rickman and indicated that this court refused to take the position that in that case that an express warranty could limit an implied warranty or preclude one. But actually, what the court said in a very short per curiam opinion in Wattell versus Rickman was that our action should not be interpreted as approving the holding of the Court of Civil Appeals that an express warranty may not limit or exclude the implied warranties described in Umber versus Morton. We express no opinion on that question. In the cases that had preceded Umber versus Morton, we set out a number of them in our brief, where back as far back as the 1920s, the Commission Appeals had fairly held that an express warranty could limit the and could exclude an implied warranty. Now, the courts have been more generous in straying from that path in the case of homes where there was no specific intention to exclude an implied warranty. And in some of those cases, they've also expanded the discovery route. But under the way this court has granted the writ on the first 2 points in this case, that is not involved, as I understand it, in what we're here for today. We're here simply on whether or not they're entitled to recover on an implied warranty and whether or not the express warranty excludes that implied warranty.
Counsel, the whole case, all the points are before the court, granting the writ on particular points simply in this case, but this is where we've got to the focus, but you can go wherever you want.
All right. Then the case was filed in 1975, November 3rd, 1975. Now, an interesting thing, the Bond Building Corporation that we had a contract with, shortly after they accepted this building, sold it to Set Warwick Company. And Vaughn Building Corporation owned no interest in it after that. And they had an agreement with Steck that, first they leased it to Steck, and with an agreement that Steck would maintain it. And then they sold it to Steck. At the time this suit was filed, Steck Warlick owned the building and not Vaughn Building Corporation. After Steck filed the suit, we raised the question of no privity of contract, and it was transferred from Travis County to Dallas County on a clear privilege. And sometime after that, on or about October 28, 1976, Vaughn filed an intervention. They intervened in the case. This was some almost 7 years after the building was accepted and completed. And in their intervention, they said that they were not asking for any recovery on their own, but they were saying that State Water ought to recover something from it. Now, after that, after October 28, 1976, then the posture of the case changed. Vaughn and Set examined their respective positions and found that Set Warwick had really not ever been authorized to do anything or bring any kind of lawsuit on behalf of Vaughn. And the attorney for Set Warwick filed an affidavit, which part of the record, saying that he found that he wasn't authorized to bring this suit on behalf of Vaughn. And he, they asked to substitute parts. And then after that, for the first time, Vaughn came in and asked to substitute themselves as a party for Set Warwick as plaintiff in this case. Now we believe that from that point on, it would clearly get into a situation where it is barred by the 4-year statute of limitations. There has never been, as far as I have been able to find, any authority in this court where the 4-year statute of limitations was not applied in a building contract case where there was no allegation of fraud or mistake. Fraud or mistake is not in this case. And therefore, the 4-year statute of limitations would have run 4 years from January 8, 1970. And this case was not filed until some period later than that, and filed then by a stranger to the contract. Filed about 7 years later by Vaughn. We believe that there is no reason for the parties not to be bound by the contract. And we're reminded of some language that this court quoted from Leonard Seed Company versus Prairie Canning Company, a Wisconsin case. And the court wound up by saying that it is not claimed that the contract is void because contrary to public law or public policy. And if not, effect should be given to it. If it is conceded that the contract is one-sided, it must also be conceded that the parties had a right to make a one-sided contract if they saw fit. Now this case is not a one-sided contract, but the builder had a right to limit his exposure. And as you will note from the amicus curiae, that if this were not so, if we could have a situation where the claimant could come in 5, 6, 7, 10 years from now and make claims, then a builder could never know what his exposure was if all they had to say was that until I discovered it, or should have discovered it, the statute of limitations doesn't start running. And in this contract, the parties specifically agreed otherwise in order to agree on what their exposure was. And we believe that under the cases that we have cited and the cases that this court has handed down before, that we had a right to do that. We cite a number of cases that have been decided by the various courts of civil appeals that where the parties, VI case, for example, the VI case thrashing machine versus Hall, where the parties expressly agreed upon a warranty, the law must, in the absence of fraud or mistake, conclusively presume that they have included in their express agreement whatever of warranty is to prevail between them respecting the matter to which it refers. And it is our position that the parties have done exactly that. They decided what would be covered and what would not, and on the workmanship and quality of the materials, we agreed that for 1 year, we will be responsible for the workmanship and the quality of materials, and if you give us written notice. And there was no claim made of any type within that 1 year that there was any problem with workmanship or with the quality of material. The Langford case that we cited in our brief also is to the same effect. Now, open and obvious in our case was something that all the parties thought about. They also thought about those things that were not open and obvious. And they specifically agreed for that cutoff period as we believe they had a right to do. And I have some time left and I'd like to take it to close.
Mr. Counsel, the argument from the panel.
May it please the court. I will present arguments this morning in response primarily to Austin Company's criticism of the Court of Appeals' use of an implied warranty theory, while my colleague Mr. Hammett will present to the court argument relating to the express warranty theory as an alternative basis on which to uphold the Court of Appeals' decision. Mr. Luna has essentially correctly stated the facts, and there are just three that I would like to emphasize as being particularly important to our argument. The first is that there are indeed several express warranties or guarantees, agreements, whatever you wish to call them, involved in this construction contract. The first is, as Mr. Luna mentioned, an agreement covering defects discovered within 1 year, an agreement essentially to repair those defects. There are specifications found in the contract that the roof would be installed in accordance with the specifications for a 20-year bondable type roof. And the third is an agreement among the parties that workmanship on the roof, workmanship on the building, would conform to commonly accepted trade practices for good construction in this class of work. The second fact I would like to emphasize is that attempts to repair the roof were made within the first year of occupancy by the Austin Company, and that numerous efforts to repair were made over the ensuing several-year period. Many of these attempts were temporarily successful. The leaks would stop, and then shortly thereafter, leaks would start again. The third point I would like to mention and emphasize, the third fact, is simply that throughout this time period, the Austin Company informed the Vaughan Building Company that the problem with the roof was maintenance. It was not construction. This later, at least according to the jury, turned out to be patently false, and I would suggest that that is an example of mistake. Now, the basic question that I will be arguing this morning is whether any express warranty without an express disclaimer of implied warranty is effective to exclude any implied warranty that might otherwise arise. Of course, our answer is an emphatic no, and I have basically two angles at which to come at this. Both of them based on areas that I think we can have some general agreement on. First being that we would not really have the problem that we have with this Court of Appeals case if the building we were talking about was a house instead of commercial construction. The point is made quite emphatic in both the amicus brief and the brief of Mr. Luna that there is a clear exception when you have a private home involved, particularly because a business is so much more sophisticated than a home buyer. And therefore, to have found an implied warranty of fitness in this case, if this had been a home, would have been a much more logical result, according to our opponent. The second area where we may find general agreement on among all of us this morning is that the Court of Appeals did make a very broad statement when it said that that an express warranty does not limit or exclude an implied warranty of fitness. We would submit to you that we will, of course, argue that an implied warranty, that is essentially correct. But yet I will also argue this morning that if this court is not willing to go quite that far, nevertheless, this court could agree that although some express warranties can eliminate or limit an implied warranty of fitness, that in this case, these express warranties are not inconsistent with an implied warranty of fitness. Turning to the extension of the home implied warranty of fitness to the commercial context, let me say first of all that it is not as drastic an extension as it may seem from our opponent's comments. Indeed, there is a 50-year-old case cited in our response to the amicus brief, the Metropolitan Casualty versus Medina Rural High School District, that interestingly enough also involved a leaky roof, as in this case, and the building was not a private home, but instead was a school building. In that case, the contract had written specifications, very much like our specification of a 20-year bondable type roof. And the contractor, as here, argued that his full obligation was stated in the contract, and it was to perform his job in building the school building in accordance with the specific plans and the specifications of the written contract. The Court of Appeals disagreed with him, saying that the contractor was also under an implied obligation, additionally, to do all the work required of him or performed by him in a workmanlike manner. This obligation, said the court, this implied obligation was present despite the primary obligation to perform according to the written specifications and agreement.
Counsel, is there a difference between the agreement to build in a workmanlike manner and the implied covenant to do so?
An implied warranty of fitness?
Yeah.
Yes, sir, there is.
Did you say that the agreement to build in a workmanlike manner is an express covenant or express contractual?
Yes, sir.
I take it your argument is the fact that the no implied warrant wouldn't exclude the building express provision that the good and working like money. Is that the position?
Yes, ma'am. Peter, do you say that again?
Let's assume that there's a humble situation here. A homeowner has a roof put on, and the roof is flat. There are no implied warranties in this case, but he agreed to build good. The roof goes on, and it's dry, everything looks fine, the homeowner says good and paid. Then comes a 14-inch rain, and the roof leaks all over. The builder says, well, no implied warranty. I said so. This is where you're home free because
no, Your Honor, I've said that the point about him specifically stating in the context that there are no implied warranties would be quite a telling factor. Let me say that the rest of what I'm trying to argue is that drawing a line between a private home situation.
Well, whatever. The express contract is still written in working like now, provided there are no implied warranties.
That's right.
There's no cause of action for anything because it says no implied warranty.
Well, there'd be a cause of action under the express warranty to do the
work. Well, I wondered if you sued under that as well as under the implied warranty.
We did sue under express warranties in this case, Your Honor. And Mr. Hunt will be referring to that after. What I'd like to argue for this morning is essentially an inquiry that is utilized in the out-of-state Supreme Court case cited in our response to amicus brief that does not draw an arbitrary line between the private home situation and the commercial building situation as our opponents try to do in this case. Obviously, you're going to eventually have fact situations of the mom-and-pop grocery with the mom-and-pop living above the grocery. Is that a home or a commercial building? But the out-of-state case, and I feel like this is the way that the trend in this case, in any event, according to this Court of Appeals cases, looks to four factors on implying warranties in this type of situation. First is simply that the contractor holds himself out as competent, that he generally built this type of building or is competent to. The second factor is most telling and goes right to the point of what I'm trying to emphasize, and that is that the owner has no particular expertise in the kind of work contemplated. Now, this should not, and in other states, does not mean that the owner cannot be a business. It means that the owner should not have expertise in the particular area involved, which in this case, of course, is the construction of a roof. Third, that the owner does not furnish all the specific plans and blueprints. And fourth, that the owner at least tacitly indicates his reliance on the skill of the contractor after making known to the contractor the general purpose of the building. We would submit that all these four factors are here, as incidentally they will virtually be in virtually all home cases, and that in a commercial situation, commercial construction situation, when these four factors are present, an implied warranty of fitness should be available. Remembering that this court itself has stated that an implied warranty theory is not contractual, not dependent primarily on the intention of the parties at the time of the contract, but yet as a tort concept, we feel that an implied warranty in this commercial situation can be, is present. Let me quickly go on to my other aspect, which is that although some express warranties could limit or exclude an implied warranty of fitness, that in this case, in this contract, we have no express warranties inconsistent with an implied warranty of fitness. Again, our basic point being that express and implied warranties can be in some contracts together where they are not inconsistent. Logically, an agreement to repair the defects discovered in 1 year does not clearly contradict an implied warranty of fitness. It covers defects discovered within 1 year and not latent defects. In light of an absence of warranty as to latent defects and no express intention in this contract to limit or exclude all other warranties, it is not wrong to find an implied warranty of fitness. Consistency becomes even clearer on noting that the contract does indeed also contain a provision regarding workmanship and also specifications regarding a 30-year bondable pipe roof. Finally, I would like to mention the interesting Supreme Court case of the City of Midland v. Waller, and I say interesting because our opponents attempt to use it against us. The amicus does not mention it, and the Court of Appeals thinks it supports us. We also, of course, think it does support us, though it is not 100% on point. In that case, there was a contract for the construction of a swimming pool which had a 1-year express warranty. Defects were discovered 20 months later, obviously 8 months after the end of the warranty period, so there was no claim for breach of the 1-year express warranty for construction. This Supreme Court held that latent defects evident after the one-year warranty period, which could not have been discovered by the exercise of ordinary care, may be made the basis of a suit for damages. We submit that to hold the bond building company limited entirely by the express 1-year warranty in this contract would not only thwart the policy, or at least it should be the policy behind implied warranties, but also the policy inherent in the City of Midland case. An implied warranty fitness in this case flows naturally from the facts of the case, including the latency of the defect, the lack of our expertise in the area, plus the actions of the parties, and even the language of the contract with no disclaimers and promise of good workmanship. At this time, Mr. Hammett will discuss another way to uphold the Court of Appeals involving the area the Court of Appeals specifically declined to decide and write on, and that is the express warranty aspect.
May it please the Court. I want to make one thing clear about this case and the fact that these parties thought they had a contract and were performing under the contract until June or July of 1973. That's when the last work on that roof stopped. There had been no disputes up to that time. They had amicably involved repairs up until that time, and there had been nothing to prompt the lawsuit up until that time. And 2 years later, the lawsuit was filed. This attitude that this lawsuit was lying there stale and dormant for 7 years is just simply not the fact of this case. Now, as to the express warning in this case, I did sue under an express warning. I sued under the very express warning that everything revolves around in this lawsuit. That was the primary basis of the suit. That warning, and I'll read it, it may be a little bit of a phrase, was that the Austin Company guarantees this work against defective workmanship and material for 1 year from date of completion of the work. Now, it could stop right there, and many express warnings do stop right there, but it didn't. It went on as follows. And then what followed this? Upon written notice of any such defect, Austin will make necessary repairs, or at its option, tell us to make necessary repairs. Now, I realize that the record in this case, or at least the judgment so heretofore rendered in this case, do not seem to deal with that argument under the express warning. And it has been my experience throughout this case that I have been unable to get anybody to talk to me about my theory under this express warning. Here's my theory. Austin guarantees work against defective workmanship and material, and that is defined later in the contract, as something less than commonly accepted trade practices for good construction for 1 year from date of completion of the work. Now, if the warning stopped right there, what would we have? First of all, what does that mean? The old cases say that if a defect existed in the construction of the work, then that warranty was breached upon the date of completion, and the statute of limitations began running on that date, and we were out of luck, filing it 5 years later. What would the cause of action be if the warranty were limited to that? The cause of action would be a breach of contract, a failure to construct the building in accordance with commonly accepted trade practices for good construction. What would the remedy be? The remedy would be damages. And the 4-year statute of limitations would have run long before this suit was ever filed. When must you assert that defect, if that's the extent of the warrant? You've got to assert it within a year. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean filing suit under the old cases, but you've got to assert the defect, as with an automobile. 12,000 miles or 12 months, whichever comes first. You've got to assert that defect. Now, the term warranty in the law of Texas and all over is more or less a term of art. And if you're not careful, you get into using it as a term of art and you don't think about it as a contractual term and what it means outside of what precedent has said the word warranty means from a stare decisis point of view. All that means is that you got the right to claim that defect within a year. This contract goes far. It says, after what I just read, it says, as follows told. Upon written notice of any such defect, Austin will make necessary repairs, or at its option tell us to make the necessary repairs. They could do them themselves, or they could tell us to go spend the money and do it. The evidence in this case indicates that they wanted to do them themselves. They didn't want us up on that roof. And they did it for 4 or 5 years. Now, upon written notice of such defect, Austin will make necessary repairs. First of all, what effect does that have on the basic agreement about warning guaranteeing against defects for 1 year? First thing it does, it tells us what assertion of claim is necessary. Written notice. There was some question as to whether that written notice was timely given. I think the Court of Civil Appeals dealt with that just fine. There's nothing in the contract that says it's a matter which time is out of the essence. There's nothing in the contract about that. The express language of the guarantee doesn't even require that it be given within the year. It just talks about defects within the year. So we did give the written notice. They had actually come and repaired on the building during the 1 year following completion. Now, what is the major effect of that limitation? It provides an exclusive remedy for us. The Austin company can't have this thing both ways. They can't say that that express warranty eliminates all implied warranty, and at the same time say that we could have done something else under that warranty. That provided us with an exclusive remedy if the Austin company's right. And our exclusive remedy was to get them to repair. We couldn't sue for damages. We couldn't sue for specific performance. We had to go to them to repair that roof, which we did. Now, I don't know whether the point will be made that those repairs had to take place within that 1 year period, but that to me would be patently absurd. Suppose the defects appeared on the last day of the year, and then would they be in breach of their contract if they failed to repair that defect within 1 year? Obviously not. There's got to be some period of time within which they're entitled to repair that roof. There's got to be some period of time within which we cannot sue them for failure to repair that roof, or for a defective roof. The cases and the established body of law that if the contract doesn't provide any period of time, and it doesn't, then the law provides a reasonable time within which to repair that roof. Now, what is a reasonable time? Some cases have held that it's a question of fact. Some cases have held it's a question of law, and some have held it's a mixed question of law and fact. Most of those cases arose from the question of whether or not the contractor had been allowed a reasonable time. In this case, that's not even a fact issue. The only reason it's an issue in this case is because of a statute of limitations. The facts are undisputed as to what that reasonable time was. These parties operated under that provision of the contract until July of 1973. And the facts are undisputed about that. The parties made their own reasonable time. I can't even see what a fact issue would be as to what a reasonable time was in this case. Because there wasn't any dispute as to whether the Austin company was performing its contract. Or there wasn't any dispute as to whether we had given them a reasonable time to perform the contract. Everybody agreed it was a reasonable time. Until July 1973, when my client made a demand upon the Austin company to replace the roof, and the Austin company refused. At that point, that contract change went in, and that's when the statute of limitations started running. Now, this is not unusual. This is not a new situation in Texas law. I'll say that it is a fairly rare situation as far as precedent is concerned, specific cases. But there is a case, J.W. Travis Drug Company versus Nichols, 194 Southwest 484, the civil appeals case out of Dallas, no writ, 1917. In that case, it was the question of whether all it was is a repair contract. You see, I take the position that we've got two different warranties, or agreements, whatever you want to call it. One was they were guaranteeing against defects for a year. And the second one was, if those defects arise, what do we do about it? And I'm saying that this case is completely different from the old cases, which involve just that 1 year warranty where there's nothing said about what has to be done. That Crowder case involved a leaky basement, and a man undertook to repair that leaky basement, and the nature of the leaks was such that they came in from everywhere, several hundred leaks. The question in the case did not involve a statute of limitations. The question was whether the owner had given the contractor sufficient length of time, a reasonable length of time, within which correction. The contractor attempted to correct it, and finally the owner filed a claim and asked for all of his money back. After many numerous repair attempts, the court in that case, and what's pertinent here, is that the court said that as long as the parties are performing under that repair contract, as long as they're performing, then you're dealing with a reasonable length of time. No one else can fix that time for the parties as to what a reasonable length of time is. The one other thing I want to tell the court, I tried this case on this basis primarily, and of course there was also the implied warranty question. It seems to me that the implied warranty question is a question of policy. In this case, we did have an express standard by which these people were to construct this building. And that was, they had to construct it in a method commonly accepted trade practices for good construction means. Now, is there, in addition to that, an implied warranty of fitness? The implied warranty of fitness, it's hard to tell what came first. Was it the fact that people were trying to exclude any kind of warranty and prevent any landowner from having a remedy for an effective construction? Or were those cases, did they come about because of the statute of limitations question? Because it seems to me, and noticed that many of these cases do revolve around the statute of limitations. Latent defects, hidden defects. And it seems to me that this court, and certainly it has reserved its ruling on this question in the past, but this court has the problem of deciding whether or not latent defects and the landowner's right to sue for those latent defects after a period of, say, 1 year has expired. This court has the job, I believe, to decide whether or not the statute of limitations cuts off causes of action for latent defects. And I think, to me, that's the basic question involved in the implied warranty. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take the brief recess.
Please rise.
The rebuttal argument from the petition.
This court, in regard to the City of Midland versus Wallace, that they have felt is of some benefit to them, would point out that in that case, we didn't have the kind of contract that we have in this case. In City of Midland versus Waller, all this court said was that construing it from the four corners, you made an agreement to do several things. One of the things, there were two provisions in the contract that are not in ours, the Articles 20 and 21 that are quoted here, as well as this contract in City of Midland versus Waller specifically provided that neither the final certificate of payment nor any provision in the contract document nor partial or entire use or occupancy of the building of the premises by the owner will constitute an acceptance of work not done in accordance with contract documents, or relieve the contractor of responsibility in respect to express warranties or responsibility for faulty materials or workmanship. Now, ours is different from that. In that regard, the contract in this case provided for an inspection and acceptance in paragraph in Article 11. And it said that payment in our case doesn't constitute acceptance for anything that's not open and obvious. But as I pointed out earlier, it went ahead to say that there will be a final acceptance, there will be an inspection, and they then will make a decision on whether or not to accept it, including those things that are open and obvious, that are not open and obvious. And the language reads exactly as follows. At the time claimed by Austin that the work is substantially completed, the entire work is subject to the inspection of the owner as to defects not obvious upon inspection during the progress of the work. The final certificate of payment shall be conclusive evidence of performance of the contract. So we had an altogether different agreement in this case. And the court simply pointed out in the Waller case that they had said the opposite of that, that payment shall not constitute acceptance of the work and shall not relieve any responsibility insofar as the owner is concerned. I would like to mention that Ms. Williams mentioned that there may have been some mistake. They don't plead that. This case was not tried on mistake. There's no pleadings on mistake or fraud. No issue to the jury on either of those issues. Mr. Hammett says that...
What you're saying is that if you have a contract to build a building according to plan specifications, and your company builds it according to plan specifications, then at least that's tough luck.
No. Depends on when it starts leaking.
What difference does that make if you build it according to plan specifications?
Well, if you built it, might not make a difference if you built it close. But the question in this one is whether or not there was defect. And even the plaintiff contends that the mere fact that there's a leak doesn't mean there's a defect. And therefore, if you built it according to plan and specification and it leaks, and there is a leak, there may not be a defect, if that's what Your Honor is saying.
Yeah.
If it's built not only according to plan and specification, but in a good workmanlike manner.
Well, that may be a horse in a cup.
Yes.
If you build it according to plan and specification, there's no question that you build it according to plan and specification. But at least that's not your problem, is it?
Right.
Contract says you can build according to the plans and specifications in a good and workmanlike manner, evidently, where are you?
And if we fail to do it in a good and workmanlike manner, then we've got a problem if it's brought within the period of seconds.
Okay, back up just a little bit. Okay. You say that you've got to be notified about any defects that have happened within 1 year. You say that paragraph 13 says that you got to be notified in 1 year, within the year?
That's the interpretation of paragraph 13.
Well, you just talked about a defect that appears in 1 year, doesn't it?
Well, it says we guarantee the work against defective workmanship and material for 1 year from the date it's complete.
So if a defect, if the roof starts leaking, let's say 11 months after completion, and you're notified on the 13th month, isn't that sufficient?
It may not be, but if it is, unless suit filed within 4 years, it is not.
And let's continue on. Let's say that over the 13th month, they notify you that they notify you in January, leak occurred, or restart leaking in November. Well, okay, that defect happened within 1 year. We're going to fix this part. You come out and you start working on it. And so it doesn't rain for 6 months. Next time it rains, it leaks again. Folks call it the way it didn't quite fit. It's okay to come back out. They put another layer of tar on. That rains 6 months more. But each time it it rains, it leaks, and you come out and attempt to repair it. When does the static limitation start running?
All right, now, until we get into where it's defect. Now, if we're talking about a letter that they wrote, let's say, a little over a year, but at the same time, they contended to the jury, and the jury found that they didn't even know there was a defect until October 21, 1974. They argued to the jury much later than that.
But the roof leaked,
but they're not suing on that. They're suing on defect, they're suing on defect, which they say, and that's the only thing that's involved in this suit. They're suing on defect, which they say they didn't know existed until October 21, until they should have found it out, the jury said, in October 21, 1974, but they didn't. November 29, 1972, but they didn't actually know it until October 21, 1974. So the defect that they're suing on, they're talking about one thing, a roof is leaking, but they put on a lot of evidence, all just a leak here and there. That's not a defective roof, and that's not what we're suing for. The defective roof, we didn't know the roof was defective until October 21, 1974, they claim. Well, the jury found under the contract, they had an obligation to find it. Now, they had an alternative. This roof was thick. Nobody can expect a roof within a period of 20 years that it may not leak. But this provided that it be built so that they could buy a 20-year bond. So that the bonding company would think that the certificate or something did happen. They chose to save the premium. They didn't buy the bond. So in this case, they didn't buy the bond. And I think that shows the intentions of the parties insofar as lease. Everybody knew that something's going to happen, even if it's built in good and workmanship manner. And they go to great lengths to point out that a mere leak is not a defect. So these leaks that they're talking, and their testimony is in abundance, that those leaks up early did not indicate a defective leak, a defective roof necessarily. And therefore, we didn't know that the roof was defective, and they're curious on that. And the instructions connection with it, the court asked the jury, do you find that the roof was defective? And then in connection with that, the instruction said that the word defective or defect means that the roof was constructed below accepted standards in the roofing industry so as to make the roof unfit for its intended purpose on January 8, 1969. And then they said the jury answered in their favor on that. But then when did Vaughn know about this defect? And the jury says they didn't know about it until October 1, 1974. So he says, we're carrying out the contract on the one hand and working on fixing these defects. So they can't have it both ways. Either they knew about those defects back there and the statute of limitations was long since run, or at least October 21, 1974, they say they found out about it, and that is the purpose, we believe, of the four-year statute of limitations, and it should not be told unless there's fraud and mistake. And we believe that that is the general crux of this lawsuit. Now, for example, if we have an automobile wreck, and if the defendant says that, I'm going to think about that, and we're going to try to work it out, but never gets around to it, and 4 or 5 years later, they file a suit. The statute of limitations has run, and that's what we think has happened here, since there is no claim of any kind of mistake, and certainly no claim of fraud in this case, that from 4 years from 1969 would have, and that's the date of acceptance, 4 years from the date of completion would have been, of course, a year earlier than that. But there was no suit filed by anybody. And then Vaughan Construction Company didn't come into it until several years after that. So there was a remedy that the, and looking at it again from the four corners, these parties realized that something may happen to a roof during the meantime, even if it's built in a good workmanlike manner. And therefore, they provided for a for it to be built so that you could buy a 20-year bond. Now, that didn't guarantee the roof for 20 years. The testimony shows that at the time it was finished, a bond would have been issued on it. It was built so that a bond, a 20-year bond, could have been issued, but the owner of the building chose not to do that. And the city of Midland case, situation there was different in another way. Not only was the contract different so that they didn't have the cutoff, there was no question of the statute of limitations in the city of Midland versus Watt. The statute of limitations had not run, and from the four corners of the document, the court in that case said that they had not they did not have an agreement to limit the warranty. In this case, we have both. Number one, we had a very clear agreement. We said that final payment is conclusive evidence that we complied with the contract. And they agreed to that. And then, at that point, on that subject, the statute of limitation, we believe, run. Just want to say quickly that if something is built within the plan, within in accordance with the plan and specification, and in a good and workmanship manner, and we believe that that means, as a matter of fact, that that you complied with the fitness. It is fit if it's built in accordance with a good and workmanlike manner. And the statute of limitations started running on that question from the day it was completed. Thank you very much.
The council cases submitted on written briefs and oral arguments of both parties to be excused and concentrated.